Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. As you can see, we're late here because I've been trying to think through some stuff with my good friend, Joseph Wang. If you're not familiar with Joseph, he goes by FedGuy12, I believe, on Twitter. And his blog is FedGuy. Is it FedGuy.com?
FedGuy.com.
Yeah, and Joseph is just incredible. He spoke at Rebel Capitalist Live. He just completely blew everyone away. And he's got some incredible posts, and he used to work on the trading desk at the New York Fed. So in 2022, we've been talking a lot about quantitative easing, tapering, quantitative tightening, and Joseph was one of the people that actually executed those operations for the Fed. So Jerome Powell would say, Joseph, we need $120 billion in QE. And then he'd go on there and he'd buy the actual treasuries and mortgage-backed securities from the banks or whomever. And so there's very few people that know as much about the financial plumbing as Joseph Wang. So well, first of all, thanks for coming on and helping us walk through this. And we're going to get into the article.
Thanks so much for having me, George. I love coming on your show.
Yeah.
And it was great to see you in Rebel Capitalist. And I know I've met many of you in the audience as well. So it's great to see all you guys again.
Yeah, and you can tell, guys, I've really been racking my brain here to try to, not only answer my own questions, but then try to explain this to you guys, because what we're talking about may seem very esoteric, but it is, I think it's just incredibly important, and you just cannot be a prudent, sophisticated investor in today's world without understanding what's happening on the balance sheet of the Fed and the commercial banks. You're just whistling by the graveyard. I use the example of a real estate investor in 2005 or 2006. It's really, really good at real estate. They know how to pick out the school district and force equity and get the right loan from the bank, but yet they're completely oblivious to what's going on with mortgage-backed securities. And obviously when that hits the fan, they're gonna get completely wiped out, because that's a cross current that's a lot more powerful than whatever they're doing at a local level. So, Joseph, let's probably go over your article first. That's easiest. And then we've got an article that we're going to briefly touch on from Jeff Snyder. So we could maybe look at quantitative tightening or what the Fed might do in 2022 from a couple different angles. So I'm going to pull up this recent article that you wrote, the QT time bomb. So if you've got this pulled up, do you want to kind of take us through this in order?
Yeah. So, I was on the desk when we were doing QT, and I did a whole lot of work as to how QT works. When you're at the Fed trading desk, you get access to just enormous amounts of information and people that you can speak with. So you get a very good view of what actually happens during QT. And if you remember last time the Fed did QT, it was all fine until one day the repo market broke, and then it was not fine. And then we had to basically restart asset purchases. So I was listening to Fed President Bostic. He was saying that, we're going to do QT, and we're going to do at least $100 billion of QT a month. And I just, maybe he wants attention or something like
beginning.
That.
This is at the beginning?
No, this is just like a couple of weeks ago. So,
I see. So now you're kind of rolling your eyes.
So I was like, oh my gosh. And, I thought he was just joking, but I think everyone on the Fed was like, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. And I just thought that was just comically insane, really. The market probably can't handle that in my view, based on how I understand QT. And so I think what I'll do is I'll walk through what I wrote. I'll go over just what QT does, what happened the last time that we did QT, and what I think will happen this time if we do at least $100 billion of QT a month. Now, for your reference, the last time we did QT, we started out at $10 billion a month. We worked our way up to $50 billion, okay? So we're just starting it at $100 billion, and maybe we'll go higher. I don't know. But yeah, that's not what you say unless you think the market is too high.
Yeah. I don't want to get too far off topic, but for these people that you're referring to, do they just have absolutely no clue how it really works on the trading desk or the actual plumbing of the system? They just see it from a 30,000 foot level?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. So if you think about, let's say, a policymaker, you know, he's sitting on Mount Olympus looking to the stars, you know, where is our star? You know, let's go there. And then he just kind of says, okay, well, we'll move rates there. And what actually happens, the mechanics of it, the plumbing, it's not really his job. And so you can have these, you know, movements in the market that were not anticipated, like what happened during the repo spike in 2019.
Yeah. Okay.
So when you think about quantitative tightening, it's basically like the reverse of quantitative easing. So what does quantitative easing do? The Fed basically buys a lot of bonds. It prints a lot of money and it buys a lot of bonds. And quantitative tightening basically reverses that. Now, let's say that the Fed, let's say Treasury issued $10 billion in 10-year treasuries, and the Fed bought that, okay? So now that 10-year note is on the Fed's balance sheet. And when that note is due, what happens is that the Treasury pays the Fed back, and then the Fed takes that money and it just reinvests it. And so the loan is basically rolled over until the Fed decides it doesn't want to roll over anymore. And that's what QT is. The Fed is no longer rolling over. It's QT, it's QE purchases.
Mm.
So now what will happen then is the Treasury will have to issue, let's say, $10 billion. And someone who is not the Fed, someone in the private sector, will have to buy that. So lend money to the Treasury. And the Treasury will then take that money and then repay the Fed. And that is what QT is. And so the end result is that somewhere, someone in the private sector has less cash.
Okay, so just stop right there for one moment. So QT isn't necessarily the Fed selling assets. It's just letting them roll off their balance sheet.
That's how it's been conducted in the past. If they wanted to be very aggressive, they could sell it, but that is not how it was done in the past.
Okay, got it.
So right now, you can actually look, so this is all public data, you can look at where the pools of cash are. The banks obviously have like $4 trillion in reserves, and the reverse repo facility has $1.5 trillion. So that's what's different between this QT and the last. We're starting QT at a time where there's a lot of money in the system, $4 trillion in banks and $1.5 trillion in the reverse repo facility. Now, the question is just, when the Fed does QT, where is that money going to come from? Where is it going to siphon off from? It can either come from the banking sector, or it can either come from the reverse repo facility.
And just so everyone's clear there, when you're talking about where can it come from, you're talking about where can the money come from to buy the treasuries.
Yes, that will go and repay the Fed.
To pay back the treasuries that are rolling off the Fed's balance sheet.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Okay.
And so where the money comes from ultimately is determined by how the Treasury borrows. Now, this distinction matters is because the money market funds, who are the people who put the money into the reverse repo facility, so that's their money, they can only buy very short-dated treasuries, like treasury bills,
right,
which is basically treasury debt that matures within a year. So if the Treasury is repaying the Fed with a lot of treasury bills, then that money will just go out of the RP into the Fed. And that's actually a very, very easy way to do this, not very disruptive. So QT will go smoothly if that's what happens. If the Treasury, though, issues stuff that the money market funds can't buy, then someone else has to buy that debt, and then that money will come out of the banking sector. And so the QT repayment will be funded from money in the banking sector. So that's really the crux of what will happen. There's two ways to go about this. So my view is that it will probably, it'll be a mix of both, but it will be more longer dated debt, simply because Treasury has a target where 15 to 20% of their debt issuance has to be short dated. They target their short dated Treasury bills to comprise about 15 to 20% of their total debt. And right now they're about in the middle of that. So no matter how they issue in the future, most of the debt is going to be longer dated debt that the money market funds can't buy. So at the end of the day, what will happen is that most of the QT will be funded out of money in the banking sector.
Yeah. So isn't that, so if it's long dated, then isn't that more sensitive to inflation? And therefore, that's going to drive interest rates a lot higher.
That's kind of the point of QT. You know, you think of QE as trying to push Well, they would talk about it in terms of something called term premia. But yeah, it's basically to push interest rates lower, downward pressure on interest rates, and QT would reverse that. So
why do you think when we did QT last, or when you did QT last time, that interest rates at the long end actually went down?
Yeah, so so when the Fed is looking at longer dated rates, it's not looking at the level so much as it's looking at something called term premia. So term premia, you can think of as the difference between what the nominal rate is. Let's say the 10-year security is like 3% right now. What the Fed would look at is how does that compare to the expected path of policy? So basically what the path of the overnight rate would be over the next 10 years. So let's say the market says the expected overnight rate over the next 10 years, let's say it's called OIS in market lingo, is let's say 2%. Okay. Mm. So if the treasuries are 3% and the OIS is say 2%, then the Fed would say, oh, we have a term premium of 1%. And, you know, we can compress that if we buy more treasuries. So maybe the three-year 3% to 2.5%, or you can say the 3% went to 3.5%, but then the OIS went even higher to, let's say, 3%, right? So it's looking at that spread rather than the absolute levels. Now, so to be clear, this term premium stuff, it's kind of model-driven, and maybe it's just a bunch of statistical nonsense, but that's how it would be perceived.
Right, but I'm just thinking, maybe I missed it, but I'm thinking about the
levels. Yes, so that's what I'm going to get to.
30 are going down.
There's I tend to think of it. My own view is that there's a risk-off effect when the Fed stops buying. So when there's a risk-off effect, you know, people tend to go into treasuries. So the level of the treasury yields goes down.
Okay.
But maybe the expected path of Fed policy goes down even more, so that the term premium actually widens. And sometimes it's like that.
Okay. So bottom line here is we have two cross currents going on. We've got the cross current of the Fed rolling those treasuries off their balance sheet, and therefore the private sector having to absorb them, most likely at a higher or demanding a higher yield, especially if we have the CPI print at let's say 7%.
Yeah.
So that's one cross current. But then the other cross current is the Fed reducing the size of their balance sheet, therefore the market perceiving that as bearish, and then selling equities and moving into treasuries, therefore creating that demand for the supply that is being produced by the treasury, and therefore putting downward pressure on yield. So it's these two cross currents, and it's just a matter of is which cross current's more powerful.
Yeah, that's right. That's I think what happened last time and will happen this time as well.
We'll have two cross currents, but I think that I mean, maybe the point that you're getting at in your article is that this time the cross current of the market having to absorb the treasuries could outweigh the cross current of people selling equities and moving into treasuries to bring back down the yield that's going up. I especially struggle thinking that there's going to be market participants in the real economy that will actually buy treasuries with the intention of holding them when there is a, call it 7% negative yield.
Yeah. So that's because a lot of market participants buy treasuries, not because they kind of have to, or because their alternatives are worse. But I'll get into that. So going back to the idea that this time, so it was important to realize that this time a lot of the cash would come out of the banks again, because that's what happened the first time we did QT. Now, this is where the QT mechanism worked last time, because ultimately QT decreased the amount of cash that banks had. And so it hurt the amount of it hurt the markets where the banks were investing that excess cash to begin with. So in 2018, all through 2019, you can see there's enormous demand for repo financing. Repo volumes were, let's say, went from 800 to 1.3 trillion. So there was just enormous demand for repo financing. Mm-hmm. That pushed repo rates higher, so high that they went above interest on reserves. So at that time, you had a lot of banks with a lot of extra cash sitting around, and they saw you know, repo, I can earn, let's say, 1% IOR at the Fed, or maybe I can earn 1.1% in the repo market. Under the regulations, it's the same thing to me, more or less. So the banks began lending a lot into the repo market, hundreds of billions of dollars. So that was basically where all the excess QE cash that they were holding went to. Now, as QE, as QT went along, it basically started sucking cash out of the banking system. And so, you know, the banks, let's say you had, if you're a big bank, let's say you had 150 billion sitting in your Fed account, you only needed 100 billion. So you took the 50 billion and you just dumped it into the repo market. Now the Fed is coming down with QT. The amount of cash in your Fed account, it's gradually declining. 150, 140, 120. So you're putting less in the repo market now. So even as the demand for repo financing is surging, the amount of cash available, the marginal lender in that market, the banks have less cash. And eventually you hit this air pocket where the repo rates basically just exploded. Now, the thing about repo though, it's an repo demand is very inelastic. So a repo dealer basically, let's say, borrows in the repo market overnight to buy, let's say a 2-year treasury that it's just holding on to. So every day, no matter what, it has to renew that loan, because if the lender says, I'm not going to renew your loan, well, then it has to go sell its treasury asset that it was funding to repay that loan. And that's not what it wants to do. So on the very short term, they would pay anything to renew their repo financing, and which is why they're willing to go all the way up to, you know, in that day it was almost to 10% sometimes. So there was just an explosion in rates. There's a big dislocation. Now, when you fast forward to what's happening today, the banks have a lot of excess cash. We see that on their balance sheet, but they're not investing in repo. What they're doing with it, though, is they're buying tons and tons of treasuries and agency MBS to the tune of $1.5 trillion.
Right.
And at the same time, I mean, just look at the federal deficit, right? The debt issuance is skyrocketing. There's enormous demand for finance. The government has enormous demand for financing. And same for the mortgage market, right? Housing market is on fire. Demand for housing finance is soaring. So you have that exact same dynamic playing out, where you have a growing demand for financing. The marginal lender are the banks, and the banks are going to lose a lot of their cash once QT sips along. So you're going to have a situation where demand for financing continues to grow, and it's going to grow even more because QT, you know, the government has to find someone to replace the Fed, and the amount of supply of money into the market is decreasing. And that's going to, you know, create fragile market conditions that create circumstances where you could have very sharp upward moves in interest rates, not in the overnight market now, but, you know, in the term market.
Yeah. Joseph, before we move on, I think we might have lost some people where we're talking about the cash that the banks have parked at the Fed. Let's call them bank reserves denominated in dollars, basically liabilities of the Fed, that being reduced by the market participants in the real economy. We'll call them the non-bank entities actually buying the treasuries that Janet Yellen is issuing. I don't know if everyone's connecting those dots. So if I'm not mistaken, what would happen there is the non-bank entity would use a liability of the commercial banks, i.e. a deposit, to buy the treasury from Janet Yellen. Then what would happen is that bank would therefore take the bank reserves, and they would go down into the TGA account. And then what would happen is that dollar liability would go from, you know, let's just say it was $1,000, it would go down to zero. So the bank no longer has that liability, because that's what the non-bank entity used to buy the treasuries. But then they would have to take that $1,000 worth of assets, which would be a bank reserve, and put it down into the TGA. That's how they're basically paying the treasury for the treasury they purchased at auction. So that's why there would be less bank reserves that the commercial banks would have access to, even though they aren't necessarily the ones that are buying the treasuries from Janet Yellen. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's the advanced version. I gave the basic overview version.
Okay, cool. But
yeah.
So, and if people, if you haven't, didn't follow that, you can just rewind that and I'll probably go over it on a whiteboard video tomorrow, but I just wanted to make sure that we're clear there. So then we can kind of move on and people can build on that.
Yeah. So, you're just creating conditions, just like the repo market conditions, where you could have some kind of disallocation in yields. And you have to look at the context as well. We're going into an environment, well, where people are beginning to realize that maybe the Fed is going to hike more than they thought they would. So that means more sell-off in treasuries. We're going into an environment where energy prices are surging, oil keeps going higher. So there's a very close relationship between oil and inflation and interest rates, and so to speak. So that makes the market fragile. But another thing is that the market liquidity hasn't really scaled in proportion to the surge in issuance. So, you know, every day, let's say about $600 billion in cash treasuries exchange hands. That number is about this, that size, that depth is not too much different from it was from a few years ago. But since then, the treasury market has gone a lot bigger because there's a lot more issuance. You can think of it as, you know, the stadium getting bigger, but the exits remaining the same. So I think that all could create some fragile conditions that we could potentially see some disallocations here if we were to go down the at least $100 billion in QT movement.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think the chances are that they even get to QT?
I'm sure they'll do that. I'll rewind a bit. So coming out of the GFC, the Fed, you know, so you can see what the market is thinking the Fed will do through the interest rate futures, the euro dollar futures pricing. Yeah. So coming out of the GFC, the market was always thinking, you know, a few years out, Fed is going to raise interest rates to 4%. A few years out, Fed is going to raise interest rates to 4%. And they thought that, and they were wrong for like, you know, almost a decade until the Fed finally raised interest rates like 25 basis points in 2015.
Mm.
So the market began to understand, you know, Fed is going to keep this low for forever. And I think they think that's still happening, but I think that's, they're making the same mistake as they did post-GFC. I think they're underestimating how aggressive the Fed might have to be simply because inflation is high and they have to do something. So I think they will have to hike. And yes, I'm fairly confident they will. They're serious about the QT.
And you think they're going to do QT at the same time they start hiking rates?
I think that's a really bad way to do things, but I think that's what they're going to do.
So our time frame here, it would just be a taper down to zero. Once they get to zero, start raising rates. And at the same time you do that, start QT.
I think so. Powell mentioned this, that he's going to wait at least until one hike before QT.
Okay.
But he also mentioned that he will start QT. Well, he strongly suggested that he would start QT this year. So I think that that's something that is will happen. And if you have Fed presidents going around saying that we're going to do aggressive QT, you know, they're preparing the market so that the market won't get too freaked out when it finally happens.
I just don't think the market believes them. Maybe it does. Maybe it does. I just see the market really having a taper tantrum, for lack of a better term, if they get to QT.
I think an epic taper tantrum might even be part of the plan if you think asset prices might be too high. So,
yeah.
You know, yeah. So if you have, think about it another way. So,
how do they make that orderly, though? Because isn't that what they're most concerned with, is a disorderly drop of 20%,
by preparing the market.
Okay.
Slowly guiding the market, slowly getting you ready, making sure that you don't have markets. So, of course, we all know that the Fed blew some asset bubbles, right? So that's kind of part of the plan post-GFC. You could have Bernanke talking about the wealth effect. Now, I think it's helpful to think about why they would do something like that. So if you have an economy with, let's say, low growth and low inflation, and you want to stimulate it, one way, and you're a central bank, so you can actually spend money. Mm-hmm. One thing you can do is you can pump up asset prices. So maybe if you had some Apple stock that was went up a lot, you would feel wealthier. Maybe you would go out and buy something. And when you buy something, when you spend, that's positive for growth and inflation. So, you know, if you look at it in that lens, a wealth effect makes perfect sense. Now, if you fast forward to today, when you have, you know, basically too much money, you have a lot of inflation, nominal growth is very high. So, you know, maybe it makes sense to reverse that wealth effect a little bit. So, yes, the market would probably not like it, but I would be hesitant to think that that's not part of the plan.
Yeah. Okay. So that hypothesis, that makes a lot of sense to me. So now what I'd like to do is switch over to a different angle on this. I mean, you and Snyder are the two people that I have the most amount of respect for in general, but also when it comes to discussing the plumbing of the actual financial system. I don't think that there are two guys that are really even close to you guys as far as understanding how all this stuff works. So he had an interesting view. And so I want to go over here, Josh. And this is from an article that he wrote in 2018. And very fascinating, because you really come at this from a standpoint of looking at the cash. Snyder has a slightly different view, where he really looks at it from the standpoint of the collateral that's actually being used for dollar liquidity and funding, as you guys call it. And he says, you know, if the Fed is doing quantitative easing, they're actually pulling collateral out of the system in the form of treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, because those assets were assets of the commercial banking system, but now they're assets of the Fed, and they can't be accessed. Though, therefore, you're decreasing the amount of collateral. If you're decreasing the amount of collateral, you're decreasing their ability to basically create the type of liquidity they created prior to the GFC. I think it's probably the best way I can say it. And so if QE was actually QT in that sense, then why hasn't QT, and keep in mind he's writing this back in 2018, why has that not been QE in the sense that if they are letting these treasuries fall off their balance sheets, if the Fed is having to issue all these new treasuries, then those are going back onto the balance sheets of the commercial banking system and therefore giving them that collateral that the Fed took away in the first place. So one of the things that he goes over, which is really fascinating, is just the difference between a traditional depository institution, is what he calls it, funded by deposit. So this is just a customer goes down, they deposit, let's say, $1,000 at their Wells Fargo, and they do so by just, we'll say, depositing a check from their Bank of America account. And so what they're doing is they're basically having Bank of America send Wells Fargo an additional $1,000 liability. And Bank of America has to send them an additional asset. So they send them most likely bank reserves that are just that the Fed transfers from Bank of America's reserve account into Wells Fargo's reserve account. So now Wells Fargo has additional bank reserves that theoretically increases their balance sheet capacity to create more dollars or loans in the real economy. So this is kind of an old school way of banking that I, you know, think that's the first thing that comes to mind when I think of banking. But Snyder's saying, well, that's not really the way it works too much anymore. And he says now the way the banks work, it's more complicated if you're swapping the mortgage-backed securities for bank reserves. He's talking about the process of quantitative easing. He says, after all, Bank A is funded on the liability side by wholesale techniques, including repo, that require utilization securities in inventory on the asset side for collateral. So basically, they need these mortgage-backed securities for collateral to give them the ability to do things that those bank reserves don't give them the ability to do, possibly because they want to interact with financial institutions that might not have an account with the Fed. So can you help us maybe understand this a little bit better?
Yeah, I think what he's saying is that when you do QE, you're basically taking out high quality collateral out of the hands of the private sector, right? And you're replacing it with a bank deposit liability if you're not a bank, and a reserve if you are a bank. So this has some trade-offs, right? So if you are an investor, or let's say part of a private non-bank sector, you have fewer high quality collateral that you have because you're forced to hold bank deposits, right? And bank deposits are not the same. So you're going to have to try to compete with the remaining, treasury securities that the Fed did not buy. And so that pushes up the prices of treasury securities because you're trying to compete for them. And that's actually the whole purpose of QE. When you push up the prices of treasury securities, you lower yields. So that's actually how it's supposed to work. So on the bank side, though, but you force banks to hold more reserves because banks have no choice. It's a closed system. So one of the actually positive externalities of this is that you fill the banks with so much liquidity that they become safer. It's very difficult to have any liquidity problems when you have, let's say, $4 trillion of reserves in the current banking system.
Right.
Now, you can think, if you think that QT would unwind that, so increase the supply of high quality collateral into the private sector, then the value of high quality collateral will have to fall, right? Because there's more of it. And so basically yields go higher. So about whether or not that helps in the movement of collateral, so I don't really think of it that way. And because so this problem where central bank gobbles up all the high quality collateral and causing market problems, it's a well understood problem throughout the central banking community. And what they do is that they actually lend out the securities to anyone who wants them, and for a fee, of course, a market-based fee. So the Fed every day, it does what's called a sec lending operation, and it takes the trillions of dollars in the SOMA portfolio and it lends it out to the market. If you want good collateral, I'll lend it to you. So, and of course with the market-based fee. And so it doesn't seem to have caused any plumbing problems. Actually, I'll tell you how you can measure this. So you measure this through what's called specials. So in repo, for example, you're trading cash for collateral, right?
Yeah.
So there's something called a GC, which is a general collateral rate. That's the market rate for repo. Let's say I have cash and I'm willing to accept any collateral, I don't care what, that's the GC rate. Now, if you're becoming scarce in collateral, let's say you want a particular tenure, the one that's recently issued, then what you would do is you would go into the specials market. So you would say, I have cash and give me the on-the-run tenure. And I know the market rate for GC repo is five basis points, but zero. You can use my cash for free. So because what I want is the security. So specials activity, how negative that rate goes, how much lower specials rate is compared to GC, that's how you know if there's a shortage of certain securities.
Right.
Another way you can figure that out, you can go to the Fed's website and it will tell you it does the sec lending operation, as I mentioned. But it's actually auctioned off. So you can see if people are paying more for a particular security, then you can see maybe over there is some kind of a demand problem. And I think a few months ago, you could actually see from the sec lending operations that there's enormous demand for the two-year treasury, basically a shortage. And that has to do with people wanting to borrow it to sell it because they want to express the view that short-term rates are going higher. This program, sec lending program, really helps a lot alleviate any of this collateral shortage that might occur. It's a lot more serious in a place like Germany, because the German government is famously thrifty, right? So it doesn't have a lot of debt to begin with. So when the ECB goes and buys large chunks, there are some serious problems there that they've also fixed with a program like securities lending.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Is this just from a layman's standpoint, when I look at the Fed's balance sheet as far as what types of treasuries they own, I notice that they haven't bought any T-bills.
Yeah, they don't. They have $330 billion that they bought in 2019, and they're just going to roll over. Yeah, T-bills is not the purpose of quantitative easing. The purpose of quantitative easing, you know, put lower pressures on longer dated rates. T-bills are short dated rates. You know, there's no, it doesn't serve the policy purpose.
But do you think that's because they know that that's the pristine collateral in the repo market, or those T-bills, and they don't want to, even though people can borrow them?
Doing GC repo, it doesn't matter if you put up a T-bill or a note or bonds. So there's this big system. Let's say we're doing something called tri-party collateral. I'm sure you've read about it before. So what you would do is that you would say, let's say, I am a cash lender in Tri-Party. Okay, let's say I'm a giant institutional investor. I would tell my Tri-Party manager, Bank of New York Mellon, you know, look, I'm willing to accept all this basket of collateral, huge basket, bonds, notes, whatever. And maybe I can put some exceptions down. And if you're borrowing in GC, then you know, you just put down anything in that basket and it's fine. You wouldn't get a lower rate unless it was something in the specials market.
Okay. Now, before we maybe go to some questions, if we have time, Josh, if you can put up a link, I'd appreciate it. Can you, just before we hit the record button, you discussed how a primary dealer would utilize or actually access mortgage-backed securities without having anything to begin with, from a standpoint as they would if I got you right, they would potentially borrow those, or they would take the mortgage-backed securities as collateral because they wanted the mortgage-backed securities, but they wouldn't. They didn't have any money to give the person, the borrower, if you will, in this case, the borrower of the cash. So then they would go out and before the transaction settles, like in 3 hours, they would go out and borrow the cash. And then at settlement, they would go ahead and give the person the cash that they didn't have to begin with. And then they would have the mortgage-backed security for, let's say it was a two-week term repo, that they could go ahead and utilize in the market to make some sort of spread. So did I get that right? And if so, can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah. So the thing about repo is you can just kind of expand your balance sheet is how they would call it. So let's say I have $1, just $1, and I want to buy, and you know, so with the magic of the let's say, you know, repo market, I could put down that $1, and just for the sake of argument, say I can buy $10 in treasuries. So how does that work? So I go to the market and I buy $10 of treasuries. I take that, and it's, you know, I take the treasuries, and I, you know, I have to pay the guy who sold it to me, right? But I take those treasuries and I immediately sell them in repo. So I borrow against them immediately and get $10 from that repo loan. Well, I won't get $10. What I'll do is I'll get $9, because the lender who takes the treasuries as collateral, he's going to want a little bit of margin. So that's what the $1 is for. So $1 of margin, and then I get $9, $10 plus $1 that I had, and then I go and pay the person who sold me the treasury. So I can basically expand my balance sheet with just a little bit of money, buy the security, simultaneously repo it out, and take the cash that I get from the repo loan and use to pay the seller.
So and, then the balance sheet started with just $1.
Yeah.
And then
so the repo loan is for $9. I wasn't clear. So $10 of security, but the lender only gives me $9 because the lender, let's say, lends me $9 but holds $10 of collateral for the lender's own safety. You know, It's like you go and get a mortgage loan. You can go 20% down. The lender is secure for like 20%, right?
So now the entity that started with $1 on the asset side of their balance sheet, they've got $10 worth of loans to someone else. They, on the liability side, they have $10 worth of debt.
Liability is $1 of equity that I put up and the $9 repo loan. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And then so then they've expanded their balance sheet basically by $9.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they can just do that. What's the constraint there? Is there one?
Yeah, it's regulatory. It's things like the capital ratios and stuff like that. So if you are a dealer, you're regulated by the SEC and they have their rule book. If you are a dealer owned by a bank, then you fall under, let's say, the broader Basel III stuff. And so you are part of the great bank holding company. So it's very complicated. There's going to be, like, let's say there's the bank depository institution, the dealer, and they all count towards the overall bank holding company level regulation somehow. So yeah, you can't just expand infinitely. Pre-GFC maybe, but things have changed a lot since then.
Yeah, because that's one point that Snyder makes. It's really, really good. Is that pre-GFC there were. It's weird because I go on the Fred website. And I try to look up deposits, and one it says that there was like 5 trillion, and then the other, maybe this is it. Yeah, this one says that there was 5 trillion, and then, the other one says that there was like 400 billion. And so it's obviously that they're using a different metric, and I can't figure out what the difference is between the two.
You're looking at deposits. Owed, like say the commercial bank, the deposits the commercial bank owes, like the non-banks hold. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what this Fred.
Yeah, that's what this is. It's a weekly data set, and it's called the H8.
Yeah, but then I've seen other bank credit. Now I don't have it pulled up, or I'd show you, but where it's like checking deposits.
Okay. Yeah. So deposits come in many different forms. So you have checking deposits. You can have, time deposits, let's say like a CD, or you could have things like MMDA, money market deposit accounts. It's actually, deposit is a very broad segment. If you want to break it down, it goes into many different kinds and it changes over time as well. You have, in the past, you have things called NEO accounts. And so it's actually a complicated term. It's better to just look at deposits overall because those distinctions, those other different types don't mean as much today as they used to.
Okay. And when we had a reserve requirement, I realized we don't have one anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exact. That's one of the reasons why it doesn't matter as much.
Yeah. So, but was that applicable to this, to the overall deposits or just one subset of deposits?
So no, so different deposit types have different reserve requirements. If you think of reserve requirements as basically making sure the bank has enough, let's say liquidity to meet their withdrawals, then it makes sense to have different reserve requirements. Let's say you have a time deposit for 1 year. You know, maybe you don't need to hold as much liquidity against that because it's not going to be due for 1 year. But if you have, let's say, a checking account, maybe those could be withdrawn anytime. So maybe those are a bit more careful about that. So the exact specifics, I'm not sure, just what the exact ratios are for the different kinds, but there are different rules for it.
Got it. Wow. So that really gets into the nitty gritty because, back, let's just say, everyone's familiar when we had a 10% reserve requirement, that was really just for the big banks, and outside the US, they didn't really have any.
Yeah. It was not a useful system.
Yeah. But that 10% overall reserve requirement that you would read about on in Investopedia, let's say, that was applicable or could have been applicable to all deposits, or it could have been applicable to just certain deposits that the Fed deemed appropriate or that they deemed there needed to be more liquidity for.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a design, but what was deemed appropriate. And like you mentioned, you know, if you go out, have a London branch, those, and then just put book deposits there, and then borrow them back through your branch office, then, you know, you don't have reserves against those. So there was very much a lot of room to game the rules because it didn't apply to everything equally.
Yeah, that's what I figured. There's just a lot of gray area there.
Yeah.
And what is the definition of reserves? You know, you say reserve requirement. Does that mean bank reserves that are liabilities of the Fed? Or does that just mean any
banks,
type of cash?
Banks or vault cash. Banks or vault cash. So Federal Reserve. So reserves is a CBDC. It's just digital cash. So they're the same thing, really.
Yeah. Okay. I could talk to you and ask you another 5,000 questions, Joseph, but I want to be cognizant of your time. Let's see. Do you have time to take a couple callers?
Yeah, happy to.
Okay. Awesome. Caller, what is your name?
Hey, Dwight.
Hey, Dwight. Thanks for calling in. Do you have a question for
Hey, how are you?
Hey, good to see you again, man.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for your book.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, he presented a book to, I think, me and many other speakers at the time.
Yeah, a couple of speakers I was able to get to. The Richest Caveman. It's a pretty interesting book. But just a question. I think I've heard you in another view talking about what you see coming with the stock market, for example. And I'm wondering if this is kind of a way where you see the Fed and the I didn't catch the beginning of this interview, so maybe I missed it. But maybe for the Fed and the government to play the elections that are coming, where it's okay, we'll go ahead and raise interest rates, we'll let it go through this time, smashes the market, but so many people don't hold on the assets that are lower income voters, so it doesn't really affect them the same way it would affect someone who's higher middle income earners or wealthy earners. So for Biden, do you see that as well? He still has a lot of that voting base if that happens, unless, of course, a lot of people lose jobs. Not that I guess many people are working right now anyway. So I don't know.
I think that's a really important point you're making. There's a trade-off, right? So let's say that the Fed raises rates in an attempt to fight inflation. Obviously, that's going to impact asset markets. And so the people who have a lot of assets, maybe they're not going to be happy. But maybe the people who, assuming that this does do something about inflation, maybe the people who are being hurt by inflation the most, maybe they're happy. So, you know, monetary policy always has this distributional effect, affects, you know, people unevenly depending on your economic circumstance, whether a borrower or a lender and so forth. From what I read right now in the politics and just looking at what was on Twitter just before we started this talk, it seems like Biden is quite concerned about inflation, and it seems like the political class is making a lot of noises about that. Now, if the political class is putting pressure on the Fed, then I think that you know, it's going to be a done deal, because the Fed's job, right? Its job is to stable inflation and full employment. So it's supposed to be doing something about inflation. And I think the perception is that he doesn't want to do too much because that might crash the markets and cause political blowback. But at this point in time, you have political support as well. So it seems like everything is aligned for, I think, a more aggressive rate hike cycle. And, you know, if the political class is on board, then they will probably be able to accept volatility in the asset prices as well.
Yeah, and I think another thing too, to add to what you're saying, is if the stock market crash, how does that affect the real economy? Because we know the real economy, let's just look at the unemployment rate. We know that the real economy has really been built or is dependent on the stock market and other asset prices. So even if that doesn't affect the people who don't own shares, the unemployment rate going from, let's say, 5% to 20% would. And so it all depends, you know, does that stock market crash? Does that freeze credit markets? If so, what does that do to the real economy? Do we see a March 2020? I think that's another component to what you're talking about.
No, that's definitely true. Yeah. The credit market more important for the real economy than the stock market.
Yeah, and if a lot of the lower income brackets are leaving their jobs right now, for example, that's why our participation rate could be falling, right? Then maybe that doesn't even affect them as much. But curious for both of you actually on this, and I keep hearing this about our housing supply being so low, for example, but when you pull up that chart from the Fred, the monthly supply, when I look at it, it's actually pretty much the second highest it's been since 2018 and 2011. So it makes me wonder, well, wait a minute, we have a 6.5 months of supply of housing across the nation. And I don't know how they come up with these numbers. Maybe it's like equivalent rents or something. I have no idea. But just looking at that chart, I keep hearing all these real estate investors talk about, oh, supply is so low for housing. But when I look at this chart, I'm thinking it's pretty high, actually, relative for the last 20 years.
Almost. I think you have to break that down by it's not just housing. It's what type of housing. Mm-hmm. So you could see supply going up with McMansions. Or houses that, let's just say, are above 2,500 square feet. Because really right now, if you're a builder, you can't build anything at a profit that's under 2,500 square feet. So you can see supply increasing tremendously at that end. But down at the starter homes, the three bed, two bath ranch, 1,200 square foot, they haven't built one of those in 10 years. And they're not building any of those whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuance in there.
Mm-hmm. I think the distribution of housing might matter as well. You have a lot of people leaving the big dense cities like New York City. They're all going somewhere else. Yeah, and so you have a lot of housing in New York City that maybe is not as full as it used to. And all those people are elsewhere pushing up the house prices, that just based on my own experience.
Yeah. So in certain buckets, you've got increased supply. And then in other buckets, you've got zero supply.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, good to see you guys again. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks for the call. Okay, Josh, we got another one. All right. Hello.
Hi.
So thanks again for taking this, George. And the question that I have is, since you guys understand how collateral works in the financial plumbing, I'm seeing a ton of rehypothecation in the crypto market, and where we have something called T-bonds and T-shares, which is in the crypto world known as trillion dollar bond and trillion bond shares, where they fluctuate from $11,000 to $25,000. Nominal face value, and then have an APR of like 25%. So I'm wondering if agencies like HSBC and several others, since I see them in the crypto market, specifically in rehypothecation and staking, are they actually using these types of cryptocurrencies as collateral? As maybe we take 50% off par of the nominal value, but we're still traded amongst each other as a way to substitute for T-bills and other liquidity instruments because that's a similar name.
Great question.
Wow, I'm not super familiar with the crypto world. I'm very hesitant to think that the official, let's say the establishment, like big banks and so forth, would be very much involved. The reason being is that it's very expensive for them to do so. The regulatory charges that you have to be involved in cryptocurrency are prohibitive. So I think it's unlikely for like a established big US bank to be too involved in that. It's just going to be very expensive for them.
So GC repo might not include crypto.
Probably not. You probably have to have just a, I don't even think 50% haircut would cut it. Maybe a 90% haircut.
All right, buddy. Well, great call. We appreciate the question. All right. Joseph, you got time for one more, buddy?
Sure.
Okay. Hi, caller. What is your name? Oh, we can't hear you.
There I am. Ray.
There you go. Doing well. What was your name?
Ray.
Oh, Ray. Thanks for the call. Do you have a question for Joseph?
Yes, I do. So just been trying to think about the difference in my mind between bank reserves and deposits, and you know how bank reserves don't circulate in the regular broad money supply. And one way that I've been kind of thinking about it is that what circulates as money is dollar denominated liabilities, whereas things like reserves are dollar denominated assets, and those don't add to the money supply that circulates. Is that a good way of thinking about it?
I mean, if I want to start here, so what you're talking about, they're both dollar denominated assets and they're both dollar denominated liabilities. It's just whose balance sheet are you talking about? So if you look at the commercial banking, you got to look at least the way I look at it. There's three balance sheets involved here. You've got the non-bank entity in the real economy, so we'll call it the average Joe. You've got the commercial bank, and then you've got the Fed. So that asset, that dollar asset of the average Joe, is the dollar liability of the commercial bank. Mm-hmm. Then the bank reserve would be a liability to the Fed, but would be an asset of the commercial bank. So that bank reserve, that liability of the Fed, is never, ever, ever going to be an asset of the average Joe. Never. Right. It can't happen because the average Joe doesn't have an account with the Fed. So right. That's kind of how I sort it out in my mind. Joseph, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think your approach is the right way to separate between the commercial banks and the non-banks. So I think of it, just broadly speaking, what you think of as money depends on where you are in the financial system. If you are a bank, cash means reserves. If you're not a bank, like you and I, cash means bank deposits.
So yes.
Reserves are just money for banks. And, you know, they circulate depending on what the banks buy. If the banks buy something, they're going to pay in reserves. It's just that the banks are not going to be, you know, having dinner at Chili's, right? They're going to be buying maybe treasury securities, you know, maybe, you know, making a loan and something like that. So they don't buy real economy stuff so much. So
that's the treasury has its place as well in that because of the TGA. So it is able to use reserves.
So the treasury is like a bank in that sense. Right. It has an account at the Fed. So money for treasuries is also reserves.
Yeah.
And these two systems interact with what I call a two-tiered monetary system. And George has mentioned this earlier. And, you know, if you are in one tier, a commercial bank, and you have reserves and you send it to someone who does not have a reserve account, what happens is that, let's say I'm a bank and I send reserves to you. You can't hold reserves, but your bank can. So your bank holds that extra dollar of reserves and you get a bank deposit. So that's how the two non-banks and non-banks interact with each other.
So let's just think about that through the lens of JP Morgan buying dinner at Chili's. Right?
What is JP Morgan? Is it a building? Is it Jamie Dimon? Is it like 10,000 people?
But the bank itself, right?
Like okay, the bank. It'll pay.
Chili's. And let's just say Chili's banks with Wells Fargo.
Okay.
Okay. Yep. So what would happen is, let's say the bill was $10,000. So JP Morgan would basically have to wire the quote unquote money to Wells Fargo to pay for their dinner. So what would happen? So they would have to send them, JP Morgan would have to send Wells Fargo first and foremost, the bank reserves, you know, so that's a transaction on the Fed's balance sheet. And then they'd say, okay, Wells Fargo, we sent you $10,000 worth of bank reserves. Now you have to add $10,000 to Chili's account with you. That's your liability. You see, has happened there is money has actually been created in the real economy, dollars that did not exist before. You see, so you got to look at those transactions. Yep. You've got the liability, you got the asset going up, but then they have to add a liability to Wells Fargo account because that's going to be the asset on Chili's account.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that helps it kind of.
Yeah, it does, and so the QE process. I think of it like an asset swap, basically, because the asset that is being purchased is the treasury, right? And I was talking to I was at the event this last couple weekends ago, and I was talking to Richard Werner a little bit about just trying to understand his version of QE originally, which was to purchase non-performing assets, which in my understanding was basically a loan that's been defaulted on, so it's doing nothing in the system. So to create a bank reserve and just basically do an asset swap, it doesn't change anything. I guess my question is what does it actually do as far as the bank is concerned? I know it with an actual reserve requirement, it would give them more capacity for lending, but if the reserve requirement is zero or it doesn't matter, then what
or if there's so many reserves in the system that they're not balance sheet constrained to begin with. And you know, going back prior to the GFC, you know, this is something we were talking about, that the total reserves in the system, call it 30 or 40 billion, that was to back up, 5 trillion in total deposits at a 10% reserve requirement for the big banks. So, you know, how were they, what was, there had to be something going on that was outside of those reserves. And I think maybe the banks aren't doing it to the same degree. Well, they're definitely not doing it to the same degree today. But there was, you know, a settlement process there for the banks to transfer those liabilities, but to transfer some sort of asset that didn't that wasn't necessarily showing up on the assets or the Fed's balance sheet. I think that's probably the best way to say it.
Sure. So it's not just about what they put in, but also what they took out. I think in that example, it might have been colored by Professor Werner's experience in Japan. So you taking out these bad loans so that the banks won't be weighed by them. So you can kind of thinking it as making the banking sector healthy again. So if you're a bank and you made all these loans that are never going to be repaid, then that means you are basically very close to bankrupt. See, so what you would do is you would basically keep renewing those loans to pretend that everything's okay. Because if you write them off, maybe you go bankrupt. But if you can pawn them off to someone, then, you know, you're healthy again. Maybe I can start creating more loans again. Maybe the economy can start growing again. So I think there's that angle as well.
Yeah, because he said that it was zero cost to society. And my understanding of that was that the damage had already been done by the fact that the default happened.
Yes, that's right. And you can potentially make things better by healing the banking system so that they can, again, start making loans. Then you could start growing again. Because if they can't make loans, there's no money supply.
Gotcha.
And then you just got to worry about moral hazard.
Yeah, that's always a huge problem. That's a really hard thing to solve.
Yeah. All right, caller. Well, we appreciate the call. Great questions.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, Joseph. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. Boy, that was awesome, as always. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do and read the entire blog post that you just came out with,
where can they go check it out? If you're interested, of course, there you go. Check out my book.
Central Banking. Where can they get Central Banking 101?
It's available on Amazon.com.
All right. Good deal. Good deal.
It's great to be here. Nice to see all of you again. Good to see you again, George.
Yeah, but I want to remind everyone the URL so they can go check out your blog post.
www.fedguy.com.
Great. And then for those of the viewers or listeners who want to follow you on Twitter, it's at FedGuy12.
Yep.
Correct. Okay. Joseph, have a good day, buddy. Thanks for coming in.
Talk to you later.